Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recordings.
Testing, testing, hot out, brown cow, 1, 2, 3, 4, testing, testing. Hey, boy, you know, Ralph, I'm getting a little nervous out here. I don't know how you can keep so calm back there.
Get ready. 10 seconds. 5 seconds. Go.
Hey, I can't find nothing on the radio. You'll turn to that station.
Your one definition of a friend is someone who's there when you need him. Well, I needed him and he's here. Ladies and gentlemen, my friend Elton
Jim.
Good morning, Elton Jim.
Elton Jim.
The one, the only, Elton Jim Toronto.
I'm back. Good morning, everyone. Elton Jim, Jim Toronto filling in for David Plyer this morning. David will be back next week. But for the next 3 hours or so, till 5 a.m., I will be your humble and lovable host. So, no sleeping. No, I usually say no switching when I go to a commercial break, meaning don't switch the channel. I'm ordering you no sleeping till 5 a.m. If I got to stay up, then why can't you, right? That's all I ask. 3 hours. Is that so much to ask? You know what this week is. Roger.
I think they're buzzing you. They're buzzing the Elton Jim show.
Wow. Whoa. Oh. Whoa. What's going on here? Right. Whoa. What?
So much for the city sound ordinances overnight.
They're supposed to be flying these things during the day. What? Yeah. Wow. What the heck?
Uh-oh.
Wow.
Here comes another one.
Ho, ho, ho.
Hey, I think they're trying to get you to go up in one.
It's an air and water show. At least do the water, but not the air.
Ear and water show.
Yeah, wow.
It's hard on the ears.
Whoa.
Oh.
Whoa. Now that one was close.
That was the RAF ones.
Wow, that one almost went right past the... listen, like you can hear the people screaming.
I know, all the way 18 floors up.
Yeah. Well, I opened the...
And 4 blocks from the lakefront.
Well, I opened the window. It's getting a little stuffy in here.
Isn't it a little humid out tonight?
Yeah,
I think so, yeah.
A little sticky. Whoa! Wow. You know why they call it an air and water show, Roger?
I have no idea.
Because that's what it is.
Oh, really?
It's an air and water show.
I thought it was a trick question.
Do you go to the air and water show?
We went once about maybe 10 years ago.
Wow!
Yeah. And there's my plane. I'm sorry, I'm late.
I just want to see how long I can keep playing this and see how aggravating it can get. How fast it'll get aggravating.
Okay,
I think
that's it.
Oh, have I already achieved that?
Oh, man, about 4 minutes ago. Yeah.
I mean, that joke's still not working. Oh! Look out! You know what I love?
What?
For some reason, I'm ducking.
Wow.
Talk about, you know, I am very method.
There's a method to your madness.
I am very method.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting here. There's not a plane. There's not even any planes flying to O'Hare around here.
Yeah.
And, you know, Curtis Koch, our producer, is playing the sound effect, and I'm ducking for some reason. Just so it'll sound real. That's what I give to my art, Roger.
That's fun.
I mean, do you hear me breathing? I mean, yeah,
I know.
I sound like I'm really scared.
Yeah.
Have you ever gone up in one of those?
No.
No, you've never had that? Because a lot of times
they've been up in a jet, that kind of a jet.
Yeah, they do. The Blue Angels, they usually let a lot of times media folk.
I know, and no one's ever called me.
Yeah, now why not? You're a news guy. Yeah, I think you'd be perfect for that.
I'm not important enough.
Why? I mean,
I'm working when they're sleeping. They don't know I exist.
I mean, given your situation, not to get personal, but you wouldn't even really be able to do anything when you get scared. You just have that bag.
No, well, you know? See, and there's the other thing.
You wouldn't even wet your pants.
I don't know if, no. All over the jet. All over the cockpit.
I mean, I remember in the 80s, Jim McMahon did that, and he threw up.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, Mr. Wow. Macho threw up. I remember that story.
Well, he was probably...
Yeah, well, that's true,
preparing
too.
And a little too much beforehand. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
What were you going to say?
But I could do it.
Thursday, Kevin Powell jumped with the Golden Knights.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he skydived with one of the
Army that's pretty cool.
Troopers.
I have skydove. Is that the word?
Diven?
I've diven.
Dived?
Dived? Yeah. I have skydived. How's that?
You jumped out of a plane with a parachute.
Yes, I did.
There you go.
That makes it a lot
easier. Thank you.
Yeah, I've done that, but I don't know. I certainly enjoy, I mean, I fly on planes quite a bit, but I don't know. They say that's pretty intense, that those Blue Angel things.
I would imagine so. I was
told that the pilots, when they actually like hit the like turbo blasters, mm-hmm. they kind of have to like essentially quench and try to force the blood like up to their heads, like
really,
yeah, because when they finally hit it, they could Oof. Risk getting passed out because essentially the blood rushes
right. yeah.
from their head
out,
out,
down,
and they could pass out. So they kind of have to like
brace
themselves.
How do you make your blood flow a certain direction?
I don't know.
Now that I knew those guys Training were talented,
guys, yeah,
but wow, they're really breaking the laws of physics, which is interesting. In many ways, actually, they're certainly breaking the speed of sound or coming close to it. But, that's been going on, I believe, what did it start on, Friday?
No, Saturday and Sunday.
Saturday, so tomorrow,
well, Friday,
today.
Friday they were
practicing.
Yeah.
I remember when I worked in public relations, I used to work at 900 Michigan, right, on, the lake.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I had an office overlooking the lake, and all of a sudden, I mean, my office shook.
Oh,
when they were practicing, and they were coming pretty darn close to the building. So maybe I was just going through some withdrawals. That's why I was ducking here. Every time I hear that noise, I just reflexively duck. But I've gone, like you said, I went 1 year about 30 years ago with a bunch of friends mm-hmm. to the Air and Water Show. It's fun. It's interesting. But I'm not a war guy.
Well, you don't have to be a war guy. You have to be a plane person.
Yeah, I guess. But I mean,
and some of the water stuff, you have to be up front,
right,
to be able to see what they're doing as they come off the water
yeah.
and do whatever they're doing with whatever they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. It's kind of neat. It's kind of cool. I mean, there's no question that the pilots and all those people are just amazingly trained. Professionals who know and they do those different arrangements and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing to watch that. When I've seen it on television, but I've only gone one time, and I guess like I remember when I went in the mid '80s, and there was a reporter, as there usually is on on the beach, asking mm-hmm. people, "Oh, what'd you think?" And I said, "Well, at least we can see our tax dollars at work," because that's basically what it is. I mean, those are our tax dollars,
and the city of Chicago puts it on, sure,
right? But those are. But no, I mean those fighters, those planes.
Oh, as far as the national,
we've paid for those,
yeah.
But so I guess tomorrow or this morning, in mm-hmm. when
10 o'clock,
about 8 hours from uh-huh. now, 7.5 hours from 10 till 3, we have at the North Avenue Beach the annual Air and Water Show. Of course, as I said before, the U.S. Navy Blue Angels. We got some parachute teams, some the U.S. Navy Leapfrogs. You got the Chicago Police Department helicopters are going to be there. The Royal Air Force Red Arrows.
Oh, yeah. I saw some of that yesterday.
Nice.
On video. Really nice stuff.
Yeah. And the F-16 Viper, I don't even know what that means.
A fighter jet.
I know. I'm just saying. And the Firebirds Delta teams. Thunderbirds are a go.
What about what happened to the Alpha team? We got to deal with Delta?
I got another.
We don't get alpha, beta, gamma. Delta.
I think I talked about this a few weeks ago one time recently when I was on. I was at the airport, and I heard it again now.
What?
You go to the airport, and they're using Alpha, Beta, Charlie, you know, like right. for your gate.
Yeah.
You know, go to Alpha 32. Well, what am I, in the Air Force?
Yeah.
Just say gate A32. Don't give me this Alpha, Charlie. The average person doesn't even know what the heck that means. Charlie, go to
well,
Charlie.
Well, it's C for Charlie.
I understand
for,
that, but you're yeah. not. We're not in the Air Force. Don't try to be cool and use the lingo.
But don't you do that when you're talking to like a help desk or something? They need a certain serial number, and you got a ton of letters, and you want to make sure they're understanding the letters.
I understand that, but Charlie,
yes,
but Beta,
Charlie Tuna.
Beta,
yes,
Alpha. No, when you're dealing with the public, you have to assume that the public does not know the official jargon. So you have to say it's gate A, gate B, or gate C, not gate Alpha.
But A may be misunderstood.
But they don't know what that means.
But if they say Alpha, then they know
they
it's...
don't. They don't know.
All
that's
right,
my
fine.
Point.
Mr. I know everyone in the world and what they think.
Okay, well,
Go ahead.
Have you been to the airport lately?
No.
Have you seen who's getting on airplanes? They barely know what gate A32 means. When they get on a plane, I couldn't believe this. On a small little plane, we just flew an hour, right?
Uh-huh.
Three people were in the wrong seats. There's only 17 rows. Three people, wrong seat. Excuse me. The guy goes, excuse me, sir, you're in my seat. Well, no, I'm in row eight. The guy says, yeah, this is great. Or, this is row seven. Oh. How do you miss that?
Well,
how do you get in the wrong row?
A lot of people, they say, oh, now that I'm on, I'm going to go and take the seat I want.
Yeah, but then...
A lot of people do that.
But so, oh, you think they're doing it on purpose?
Yeah.
Well, doesn't Southwest have that policy where you essentially...
You can go anywhere you want on Southwest.
Yeah, you can sit anywhere you want.
Yeah, Southwest, you can, you just get on the plane and take whatever seat you want.
And that's what I think a lot of people on other airlines are doing. They just, I'm on, now I'll go wherever I want until someone tells me to move.
All right, so those are the same people that you believe understand Alpha, Beta, and Charlie then, right?
Well, I don't know if they understand, but, you
Let's
know,
face
they get
it.
The message.
Most planes today are like Greyhound buses.
Wow.
They are!
Well, you just pack them in?
In my day. We used to get dressed up to go on a plane.
That's true.
My gosh. Now, I mean, there's people with barely have pants on.
Wow.
Oh. Taking their shoes off, their feet. Like, what? We're in this contained tube. There's no air here. I can't open a window to get the smell of your smelly feet out of here.
I would still take that over Metro commuters.
Oh, well,
as a person who commuted on Metro for 2.5 years, I saw people trimming their toenails on the train.
I understand that.
Putting on makeup, doesn't bother me, trimming the toenails, just grosses me out. I would take somebody with their shoes off.
Well, the key word is public transport. Whenever I hear the word public anything, I run away from it. Public is not a good word.
But you drive, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. So how are you going to get from...
I know, and I hate it.
Here, let's say to visit...
In my car.
What, you're going to drive to Milan, Italy, in your car? You got pontoons on that thing?
I understand that. No, I understand, but I'm just saying...
I get to see you going past a cruise ship.
When they always honk.
Get out of the way, buddy. You're in my lane.
When they always say, the city suggests you take public transportation.
Well, right, because you're causing problems on the road. You want to drive everywhere.
That's right.
Get on my way.
Because I don't want people's toe clippings hitting me in the eye. Yeah. That's exactly correct.
Wow.
Damn it.
Ooh, somebody's got a couple of soapboxes over there.
Well, I told you, I'm a little testy. If you listen to the crosstalk, I mean, I've been 2 days now without a microwave.
First it was a phone, now it's a microwave.
I know, I've had a bad...
How are you going to exist in this world?
I've had a bad electronic week.
Yes, you have.
The bad month. Yeah, I mean, you are so surprised how you... are dependent on that microwave for that little quick 30-second or 2-minute burst of heat.
At my house, it's the garage door.
The garage
door spring broke.
Oh, you can't get it open?
Nobody can open. It only opens about like maybe
That's
less than a foot. Yep.
Yeah, that's terrible. Well, and it was worse for me is that I have an old house. I really should do this, but I still have fuses in my house as opposed to like the circuit breakers.
Oh, down in the basement?
Yeah. I still have the bad fuses, the 15 amp fuses.
We had fuses in our house, but that was an old house.
I know, like I said, my house is old, so I've never converted it because it's kind of expensive and I've got concerts to go to. So, I mean, you know.
When's the next one?
Yeah. I'm trying to think. Probably sometime in September.
Oh, not until, okay.
Yeah, Elton's taking a little time off in the summer. Yeah. He'll be back, though.
All right.
But anyway, so for whatever reason, the microwave for the last 2 weeks has been acting weird, and then it went off its rails. whenever you press in 2 minutes, and then you realize, well, that's too long,
right?
And you just open the door.
Well, turn it off first.
No, see, I don't. Am I supposed to do that?
Yeah, you should. I mean, it'll stop.
Well, see,
it's a safety measure built in. It'll stop.
Right.
But in that split second as you pull that door open, it's still shooting out little for like a split
second.
Well,
that's fine. But my point is, so all of a sudden, whenever that was my habit, I would never hit the cancel and open. I would just open the door. Well, whenever I open the door, it would blow a fuse.
Well, shouldn't that have told you at that first time
that
don't
was wrong.
Do that?
Well, but it's so well. At first, it's such a habit that I would have to keep reminding myself. So, in the last, I would say, 2 weeks, I've blown about 15 fuses. It's unbelievable!
Wow!
And so then on Thursday, as soon as I turned it on, the fuse blew, and then to Curtis's point. You know, this house is old, so whoever, jerry-rigged this thing with all the electricity back in 1910, for some reason, my microwave fuse is on the same fuse as my garage door opener.
So when you enter 5 minutes, the door opens up in the garage?
So not only am I cooking, but I'm also, making sure my car's in the... No, so
what you should do is turn your garage into an Earl Scheib. when you get the microwave going, you get a paint job.
I'll paint any car, any color for $39.95.
The bright lights come on in the garage, and it bakes the paint into the car.
Well, don't laugh. So I was going through so many fuses that I had no fuse. Like I had no spare fuse. I had to run out and buy some more. So, but because the fuse to get my car was blown because it was on the same fuse as my microwave, I couldn't get into my garage to buy a new fuse so my garage door would open.
Oh, man.
So then I had to look to see, well, what am I not using? Mm-hmm. And this is 2019, by the way.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's, 1910. So then I took the washing machine fuse, which was the same amp.
Jeez.
I screwed that into the microwave / garage door, went out, got the new fuse, and then put the new fuse into the garage door, and then back into the washing machine. Oh.
How?
Oh.
I'm sorry, but how you have survived this many years without blowing yourself up. I am amazed.
And we've been in that house for like 21 years now. But I have never blown this many fuses. I mean, my gosh. So something clearly was wrong. So then, so then the best part is, I don't have the most, expensive, microwave, right?
Yeah.
So I called the guy up. And of course, when we bought it only 3 years ago, which makes me mad, I didn't buy that protection plan. That's a big, that's a ripoff, right? Well, if I would have bought it, I would have been covered.
I worked for a retail store, and I won't say the name of it, but when you sold, if I was a cashier and I sold...
Did you get extra points?
You got some of the commissions from it.
Oh, nice.
But if that person happened to return the item that was the thing attached, you got docked off your pay.
Really? Well, see, if I would have bought that because this was a 4-year plan, and my thing died like 3 years, I would have been able to to have the guy just come out.
Yeah.
So now, of course, I call up to say, what can I do? And the guy says, well, you know what? It's going to cost you $180 for us just to come out.
Yeah.
You might the microwave didn't cost $180.
Yeah.
So I have to buy a new one.
Well, that was like my dad with the garage thing. He called the place and they said, oh, yeah, well, for the weekends we charge $500. If you want, we can come on Monday and it'll be $200.
Ridiculous.
I mean, and so it's like, all right, we'll wait till Monday.
Yeah, so now I got to buy a new one. This old one is 3 years old and I've already got to buy a new one. And he's got to come because I said it's over the range, so they have to. I can't install that. Oh, Roger, it is so not easy being me. Anyway, who is me? I'll tell you who it is. Elton Jim right here at WGN is filling in for David Plyer. We'll take a very quick break. We'll be back. Hey, no switching. There's more of whatever this is. Years ago, that historic rock and roll, piercing, screeching, historic version of the Star Spangled Banner played by Jimi Hendrix at the historic Woodstock concert. 50 years ago this weekend, Woodstock Music and Art Fair in Bethel, New York, was held on August 15th through the 17th. Actually ran till the 18th in the Monday morning, and that's when Jimi Hendrix played. Needless to say, the show was delayed a few times, so I don't think they were right on schedule. In fact, I was watching an interesting show on PBS today, in fact, about Woodstock, and the first act, no acts could get in. The traffic was so terrible that the acts, the actual music acts couldn't get in. They had to wind up helicoptering them in. So Richie Havens was there. Not the most well-known guy, but he was on the bill. And he wound up playing for 2 hours to open the show because there was no other acts there. But it became historic. And so that was 50 years ago in a time when, talk about the counterculture, really, for the first time, standing up and showing up and telling the world that we are a force to be reckoned with. Don't know how long that lasted necessarily, but for those 3 days in upstate New York on Max, is it Yazger's farm? 600 or so acres in the upstate New York area in Bethel, New York, was home to about what they say 500,000 hippies, yippies, you name it, young people, to see an amazing concert and to be there just for peace and freedom and harmony. And for 3 days, it worked. It's what's amazing is with 500,000 people there estimated, and when you see some of the aerial shots of what was happening on that farm in Woodstock, it's an amazing just group of humanity that amassed and stayed there for 3 days. Think about that. 500,000 people, that is the population of a city. There was literally a pop-up, you know, we have pop-up stores on Michigan Avenue. There was a pop-up city for 3 days. And that was really when, as I said before, the baby boomer generation, the emerging counterculture generation, really, for the first time, there was a lot of protests about the war. There was all the, you know, the growth in 67 and 68 with rock music and Sgt. Pepper and things like that. And certainly, you know, and everything that the season of the Summer of Love in 67 in San Francisco. But when those young people showed up from not only around the upstate New York, but from around the country, and in some cases from around the world, to come together to hear that music and just sort of be with people like themselves who they didn't even know existed in that kind of number, it really did make the world turn around and go, wait a minute, this is a possible force that that needs to be reckoned with and may have some say in what happens. And as we know, the baby boomer generation has been basically leading our culture for the last 50 years. And I guess one of the reasons why right now we're kind of in a cultural war to some extent is because while the millennial generation is certainly has a big number and they are young and they are doing what every generation wants to do and should do, which is exerting their economic and cultural power over the culture and taking it over and moving it toward what they believe in, that usually was somewhat of a natural progression. One generation leaves, the other takes it away. But what's very interesting about our dynamic right now is that the baby boomer generation in number was so large and culturally was so influential, and they don't want to give up that influence and that control. And meanwhile, I've got the millennials saying, hey guys, it's our turn. And to be honest, you guys really didn't do that well, good of a job, did you? You didn't leave us with this utopia that you had been promising us. But at the same time, the baby boomers don't want to let go. They're not used to being second fiddle. They're not used to being on the back burner. They're used to being the flavor of the day. And so we talk about a divided country right now politically, and certainly that's there. But I think if you look at the roots of it, if you look at the real foundation of the gap and the division, I think it's more about the generation gap between the baby boomers who, let's face it, you know, they're a very self-absorbed generation, and they always want to be cool and they always think that they're right. And they're not giving up the spotlight. They've had it for 50 years, and they're not going to let it go. Meanwhile, you got the millennials, like Curtis here, just gave me a thumbs up, and he's like, hey, it's my turn. Get out of the way, or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are a-changing. And so I think that's where we've got an interesting division. It's the new generation that ironically was raised by the baby boomers. That's who raised the millennials. What I love about all the criticisms about the millennials and, oh, they don't do this, they don't do that. And they act like the millennial generation fell out of the sky somewhere. Like they just were on some other planet.
Yeah, we just randomly appeared and ruined everything.
Yeah, do people who criticize the millennials realize that they are the ones who raised them?
And do they also realize that their parents probably said the same thing about them growing up?
But what I love is the baby boomers raised the millennials. So if you're complaining about how bad they are, guess who raised them? I don't hear that side of the story. I hear how bad the millennials are and how they act and they're narcissistic and they're self-absorbed. And I said, same thing was said about the baby boomers when they were this age. And let's not forget, the baby boomers, and you know, we're talking about Woodstock and the counterculture and 50 years ago. Don't forget, here's a word that I'm surprised I'm not hearing as much as I thought I would. And Curtis, feel free with you and your friends when you protest. I know you guys go out every week and protest at places.
Yep, when I'm not here.
Yeah, if you see somebody in their late 60s or mid-70s, don't forget, they were the yuppies. Those same people with the long hair and the beards and the peace signs and saying how everybody should be free.
And the tie-dye.
The tie-dye. Yeah. Everybody should be free and anti-capitalism and hey, man, and we're all cool. 30 years after that, they were all driving BMWs, living in the suburbs with 2.4 kids. They were the yuppies. They totally sold out. So nobody's without sin here. And as Curtis, a millennial, you know, correctly states, every generation has always looked at the generation before them and thought it was wrong, and they want to change and do things differently. It's the natural progress. But I get a kick out of everybody that's talking bad about the millennials. Well, guess who raised them? The baby boomers were self-absorbed and self-righteous, and they raised narcissistic, entitled kids. No surprise. Not to say anything against you there, Curtis. I'm just using a generality.
Yeah.
But, you know, not surprise. So, you know, don't blame the millennials. Yeah, there's you know, some of the things they say are true, but you also have to look at they weren't born in a petri dish. They were raised by baby boomer parents. So let's not forget that. Everybody's hands has some blood on them. You know what I mean? But yeah, 50 years ago, Woodstock, it really was kind of a coming of age and a coming of power of the baby boomer generation and of the counterculture generation to say, hey, we are here and look at how many people we are. And to their credit, 3 days, no deaths, no assaults, no murders. They really did what they came to do. They came to spend 3 days to hear some cool music and chill out with each other. And that's exactly what happened up there in Woodstock. Now, sadly, if you remember, in 1999, there was a 30th anniversary Woodstock concert. And at that time, probably the Gen X people, I guess you would, that would be the people who were at that. That thing ended in, you know, they were trying to, you know, relive Woodstock, right? And you know, the good vibes and at the end of the day, that on the last day, there was violence and fires and sexual assaults. And it was like, no, you can't go back sometimes. Woodstock, for whatever it is, was a very happy accident. And it was a moment in time, and it was historic. And it certainly does deserve to be looked at in historic measures. But it's also something that cannot be recreated. Impossible. It was a happy accident. It was never expected to be what it became at all. Even the organizers, in their wildest dreams, never expected that to happen. 500,000 people. No way. And yet it did happen. And it is culturally important. And so, as I said, what was interesting, I was looking through some of my old writing for something else, and I found this. I started my media career as in my 20s, early 20s, writing a music column for a suburban newspaper chain called Press Publications in the Western Suburbs. And when I was in my mid-20s, Woodstock at that time in 1989 turned 20 years old. Think about that. 30 years ago, I wrote this. And I read this column that I wrote, and I said, wow, what I said at that time seems kind of prophetic. And I'll just skip around here, but let me read a little of this to you. And you'll get a sense of what it was like for me when I was, say, 25, 30 years ago. And what the thought process and the perspective was at that time. And has it changed? Have the times changed or haven't they not? It's hard to tell, really. But I think I was a little prophetic as well at the end of this article. So the title of it is Woodstock at 20, Young Enough to be Trusted. And, of course, it's a play on the words of the one of the slogans of the day for the counterculture was, if you're over 30, you can't be trusted. But here's the beginning. Woodstock, period. By now, you've probably watched and read countless accounts commemorating the 20th anniversary of that mudslide of a musical event, the Woodstock Music and Art Fair, held August 15th through 17th near Bethel, New York. Most of these memorable moments have been related by the musical artists who performed at the festival, journalists who covered it, people who attended the event, and just plain folks who lived nearby and couldn't believe the birth of a nation was taking place on that farm. I suppose getting reactions about the event from these types of people is important to get a feeling of what it was like to be there, although if everyone who claims to have been at Woodstock actually was there, they probably would have been forced to elect a president, and also to put this event in its proper historical perspective. However, now that Woodstock has become more of a cultural icon rather than just a concert, it seems its significance and importance has grown with each passing year. Woodstock is a symbol more than anything else. The only problem is defining that symbol. The music festival unwittingly became a rally for the counterculture, an event that unified the hippies, the yippies, the flower children, the rockers, and any other group whose members were under age 30. Many children of the backpedaling of many children of the 60s, here we go. Many children of the 60s are backpedaling now to show that they haven't sold out to the establishment values that they rebelled against so strongly 20 years ago. But many of their rationalizations lose their strength when their declaration comes from a house in the suburbs with 2.4 children sitting on their knees. Several Woodstockers are now stockbrokers. And most have settled into other traditional career paths. Though there's nothing wrong with that. Many flower children do feel guilt of betrayal. But I say, hey, don't worry about it. We've all got to make a living. Everyone remotely associated with Woodstock has been interviewed. But in their effort to relive the event, the media forgot a very important group that I'd like to address. The next generation. Now, as I'm writing this, I'm a part of the next generation. Now, I'm a part of the old generation. But this was 30 years ago. The Pepsi generation, if you will. But if you want to find out what Woodstock was really about, then ask someone who wasn't there but who feels the effects 20 years later. No, I didn't hitchhike 400 miles to get there. I didn't take a bath in a dirty river. I didn't father a child there. I didn't eat psychedelic mushrooms. In fact, I was 5 years old in August of 1969. My only real memory of Woodstock is that I was probably still sucking my thumb. But here are my recollections of Woodstock from someone not associated with it. Well, maybe I should qualify that. One of the few people who doesn't claim to have been there. For me, Woodstock does have some significance. It was the first example of the real unifying force of rock and roll. Before Woodstock, rock was still viewed by many people as a passing fad that would soon fade away. But when all those people, and attendance records varied from 500,000 to 1 billion, depending on who you talk to, converged on that 600-acre farm to hear rock and roll, it sent a message to the world that this was music and this was a group that needed to be reckoned with. Let me just skip ahead here. Culturally, I guess we all wish we had a Woodstock of our own. Every generation has looked for its own Beatles or its own Woodstock, but we've come up short. You cannot manufacture a phenomenon. They just happened. Elvis just happened. The Beatles just happened. And Woodstock just happened. We've tried with David Bowie. We tried with Elton. We tried with the Bee Gees. We tried with Michael Jackson. We tried with Prince. The closest we've come is with Bruce Springsteen. But in 1989, even he now has begun to sour for some. We tried with Live Aid. We tried with Farm Aid. We tried with every aid in between. Rock and roll means freedom and community, and we've tried to show the older generation that we're trying to carry on our tradition. History will always defeat our attempts, though, to have our own Woodstock, because it will always be compared to the original, and we can never live up to it, whatever it was, which would happen in 1999. We did not live up to that. Before Woodstock, there wasn't an event to compare it to. For me, Woodstock was a muddy, disorganized, idealistic triumph. It's something for my generation to strive for, but I really doubt if we'll ever get there. We're not star children. We just want our MTV. We'll be back after this. No switching. Bully. Jim Toronto with you here. At WGN 720 AM in Chicago, filling in for David Plyer. And we're going to take a little stroll over to the Pop Culture Club with Mick Kaler. How you doing, Mick? Is Mick there? Could you put him on?
Hello.
There he is.
I'm doing great, pal.
Very good. You sound awake. Very nice.
I'm ready to go.
Yeah, we usually come to you a little earlier, but wow, at 3:15, listen to you.
Well, I took a little nap earlier, so I'm good to go.
Yeah, very good.
He's excited to be in your bordello.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
Just leave the money on the dresser, please.
Well, no. For Mick, I've known Mick so long.
I know.
Freebies.
Oh, really?
On the house.
That's right.
Wow.
Mick's money is no good in this bordello.
I love that.
Just make sure you leave the light on when you leave.
No.
Sure.
Little let me just Jimmy say, can't stand the
Mick,
dark.
For you... You are a bully. You are nightlight shaming.
Oh my gosh,
Mick, your money is no good here.
Good to know.
Your money is no good here. Well, I can't believe Roger turning on me. Bravo, Charlie SoCal. Jeez. I'll give that to you, Roger, because I make enough fun of you.
That's okay.
I have shark skin.
I know.
You son of a...
I got to go see if the power bill was paid. I'll be over in the corner if you need me.
Okay. So we go to the Pop Culture Club with Mick Kaler. And if you want to hear some of Mick's other artistic ventures, you could just watch the WGN Morning News every morning. And Mick's parody songs are frequently on there. He co-writes them with a guy named Al Flash. Any new songs that we may be hearing on WGN television soon?
Not right now, but we've been trying to think about something about the Cubs' road woes,
as far
as the road games go. So we might throw something in there because they just can't seem to win like that.
Well,
they did win yesterday.
But I tell you, and I have I don't comment too much on the Cubs on my Facebook page because I have learned that you really can't win with Cub fans. And I am a Cub fan. I was born and raised in the northwest side of Chicago, so I live and die with the Cubs, and I have. And when I criticize them because I want them to be better.
Sure, you're trying to help them.
Yeah, it's not that I'm bashing them. I want them to be better. And I see a lot of deficiencies, starting with number 70.
Yeah.
And so this week, there was this big, to-do, and there's no question. There was a horrible call, a called third strike.
Oh, that high strike on, who was that?
Tony Kemp.
Kemp, the newer player, right?
And the Cubs were down 4-2, and there was a man on first, and Kemp struck out looking, and it was a terrible call, no question. So everybody's screaming, worst call of the season, blah, blah, blah. And my point was, if he had been bunting the runner to second, like he should have, there would have been no called strike.
Sure, there'd be no problem, right?
I thought it was more bad managing than it was bad umping. Well, Cub fans just... attacked
down
me.
Your throat.
Yeah,
sure.
You can't give up an out, and we have to score. There are two runs down in the ninth. You can't give that up. I'm like, hey, you can't score two runs until you score one run. And if you got a man on second, then maybe a wild pitch happens, or maybe an error happens, or maybe a single scores a run. But a man on, a man on first needs a double at least to score.
Yeah,
and Madden just waits for that those amazing moments, those amazing clutch hits that rarely happen, and that's why the offense is so inconsistent, because they don't manufacture runs. He just plays for a big inning all the time, and sometimes
like today they only managed four hits, but that last game in Philly in that last inning, I was watching that, and I'm like,
oh my gosh.
I'm like, I should just turn the TV off now because I know where this is going.
How do you come back from that? I don't see that. I mean, if they do win the division, that's amazing, because that is one of those losses that is a turning. Like, when you look back at a failed season, you'll say, well, the season really collapsed when Bryce Harper hit that grand slam in Philadelphia. I mean, that is really one of those games. You're up 5-1. I'm so mad because I shut the game off.
It was funny because when Harper hit that, he hit it in Philadelphia, but I think the ball landed in New Jersey.
Oh, my God. And that was a shot heard around the world.
Yeah, and it was funny because they did show a shot of the Cub dugout after that.
Oh.
And it looked like some of those players had just had their dog killed. Okay?
Oh, I know. come on. That was unbelievable. But
Yeah,
so anyway, I've decided that I am no more Cubs comments for me on Facebook. Just talk to me September 29th when they announce the new manager. I'm very torn because I don't know if I would buy the Cubs' new network next year, that marquee network.
Oh, yeah, because you have to commit to the whole year to get that subscription to watch the game.
So yeah. I'm torn because I don't know if I want to pay extra to watch that. So I find myself actually watching a lot of more games this season than I have in the past, just because it's maybe the last time I see the Cubs on television.
That, or you could just wait to see highlights on Sports Center, so you could save money by doing that.
But then the other side of the coin is, I don't know if I would want to buy it, specifically, pay extra. But at the same time, I would want to see the new manager's first season. So I'm kind of torn. But we're not talking about Cubs here. We're talking pop culture stuff. Real quick, before we get into our movie review. You saw the new Blinded by the Light film.
Right, I saw that yesterday.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. But I just wanted to talk a little bit, you know, I was talking a little bit about Woodstock and how it was 50 years ago, you know, this weekend. In fact, this weekend, right now, there were people 50 years ago sleeping at 1 in the morning. Either that or Jefferson Airplane was playing.
And they were in the mud.
Yeah, they were in the mud because it did rain on Sunday, yeah. And then Jimi Hendrix, a lot of people forget, Jimi Hendrix did that amazing Star Spangled Banner on the Monday morning, on actually the fourth day.
Yeah, they kind of extended things because of delays and all
and
that.
And a lot of people had already left.
Yeah, they missed that.
They
yeah.
missed the most historic part of it. But what's really interesting when you think back, okay, the Grateful Dead was there, Jefferson Airplane was there, Creedence Clearwater Revival was there. As I said, Jimi Hendrix was there. The Who was there, really helped establish them, really, here in the United States. But what's really, when you think about Woodstock, who wasn't there is almost a bigger kind of story in that it really wasn't expected to be that big of a deal. When you think about it, you know, the Stones were not there.
True.
The Beatles were not there. Bob Dylan lived in Woodstock and he wasn't there.
Right.
You know, the Doors weren't there. Simon and Garfunkel weren't there. I mean, most of the major people, you know, the kind of historic bands of that day were not there, even though there certainly were some great bands there. But it's really amazing how, despite those major touchstone groups not being there, it still became a historical concert.
Well, just imagine the crowds they would have had if, you know, groups like the Doors and the Stones have been announced to play there, too.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, they had at least 500,000. Could you imagine? They may have had a billion there.
Yeah. And again, of course, this whole
or a million,
thing,
I mean.
This whole thing happened, and there was no social media to put it out.
No kidding. Could you imagine? Oh, gosh. Could you imagine the selfies from Woodstock? Oh, my God.
Here I am, naked in the mud. Check this picture out.
But I don't know if you heard earlier, but I found this article that I wrote 30 years ago.
I saw that, yeah.
About Woodstock, you know, at 20. And I'm like, wow, talk about, I mean, I was a millennial.
Yep.
And now I'm in the old generation. I mean, that's scary just to think how time flies. I just found this thing by accident, and but like I said, I think I was a little prophetic in that I was like, you know what, and I think it's true, because don't forget, the they tried to put a Woodstock 50 together,
and that died,
and it just never, I mean, it was, they're talking about permits, I don't know what, that to me seemed a lame excuse. How could you not get a permit for a I mean, at this point, we know how to do these outdoor concerts. I can't believe that the powers that be didn't get permits done.
Right.
There had to be some other weird behind-the-scenes stuff. But I just think, you know, you cannot recreate a phenomenon. You know, you just can't do it.
Yeah, it's kind of a self-generated thing that happens naturally or organically. And this,
yeah.
You know, this planned-out deal was nothing like that.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, just let it be, no pun intended. And it is what it is. It was a major, you know, historical landmark. It did, you know, kind of define the counterculture and sort of put them on the map as a force and as something that would certainly become influential for decades to come and even today. But you can't, like you said, it happened organically. It wasn't planned. They thought maybe they'd get 100,000 people, not 500,000. My gosh. I mean, you see some of the aerial shots of that. It's amazing.
Yeah, the bands had to get in and out by helicopter for the most part, just because of the crowds and all that.
Oh, great. And they had no. And then think about the toilets.
Yeah. Oh, God. Oh,
the toilet. I mean, could you imagine how that, after 3 days and rain, how that must have smelled? Oh.
Just imagine being on the cleanup crew.
Oh, my God. And they were. I saw this special on PBS just tonight, and they showed what that farm looked like when the people, because they just left.
Right, they bolted, left all their stuff. Yeah.
Everybody just left, and it looked like, oh, like they said it looked like the Civil War battlefields.
Just think of Lollapalooza times 10,
yeah,
right?
Without the cleanup crew, don't forget these guys were walking around with bags.
Yeah.
That's how rudimentary everything was. They didn't have any cleanup crews. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, because, I mean, to begin with, the hippies didn't even take baths.
Yeah, and then they added to it.
Yeah, so think about it. They came to Woodstock already smelling.
You know, speaking of that, have you seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood yet? Oh, you did.
Yes,
see it.
I did.
It, right?
Yeah, we talked about it. Yeah.
Yeah, and they in the scenes when they showed those dirty hippie girls. You know, the Charlie Manson.
Yeah, at the Spahn Ranch.
Yeah, first,
yeah.
First of all, when you think of Charles Manson and you think of these women hanging out, you think, oh, there's beautiful women.
Yeah.
You know, 60s, it's all free. And I saw how disgusting they looked in that movie.
Yeah.
And I was like, thank you, no.
Yeah, no, no, no. And I
dirty
think,
feet, they're dirty bare feet, and they're just, you know, you know,
sure,
they're not showering.
And I'm sure they had no disease. I'm sure they had no disease either.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Just a whole, yeah, you know, a whole slew of mess there.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, although I had to laugh, you know, because it did rain at Woodstock, and they show all the people just sliding in the mud. And then I turned on the Little League World Series and watched the people sliding down the hill.
Yeah, but Williamsport, yeah.
Yeah, on the cardboard. So I'm like, so some things haven't changed.
Right.
Jim Toronto filling in for David Plyer this morning. I'm talking to Mick Kaler in the Pop Culture Club. We'll take a quick break. Be back after this. No switching.
Leave the books, I turn up the band. Yeah, she was bright by the light. Oh, cut loose like a goose, another runner in the night.
Jim Toronto with you here at WGN 720. Elton Jim filling in for David Plyer, who will be back next Sunday morning at 2. Right now on the phone line as we enter the aura known as the Pop Culture Club, we have none other than pop culture guru, Mick Kaler. How you doing there, Mixter?
I'm doing great, pal.
Very good. So we were talking before the news about this new Bruce Springsteen film. Well, it's not really a Bruce Springsteen film, but it is certainly a Bruce Springsteen-influenced film.
Yeah, that, centered around his music.
Yeah, that just came out. And as I said, what's interesting is the soundtrack for the album is filled with very well-known Springsteen songs, as well as a few rarities. They put in a live recording of The River. From
his, yeah, he watches a video and you see some of that being played.
Yeah, from the historic No Nukes concert in 1979, which is really one of the great Springsteen performances that has been captured on film from his heyday in the late 70s, early 80s, and that is certainly something to see and hear. And then a song that plays over the credits, I believe, that he had initially written for his back in the early 2000s, late 90s, for his first son, called I'll Stand By You, but then later he gave it to the Harry Potter producers as use, you know, for use in one of their movies, and they turned him down.
Right.
Can you imagine turning down? I mean, what do you say?
Well, I think that, you know, the Harry Potter movie people were probably like, you know, God bless Bruce, but we don't need this. We've got our own, you know, our own franchise,
right,
in our own situation without tying in with that.
Yeah, so there have been rumors about this song floating around for many years, and Bruce Springsteen always said that he really liked the song, so now they finally found a place for it, and apparently it plays over the credits here. But so you saw the film, Blinded by the Light, it's called. What did you think?
I really like this movie, and the funny part is if you see the movie trailer, you think, oh, this is just a fanboy flick, and this guy likes Bruce's music and finds his way that way. And there's so much more to it. As you mentioned, he's a Pakistani kid who grows up in a very traditional Pakistani family in England. And, you know, father is very domineering, and they're kind of struggling because the father loses his job. And he has to make money for the family, and the whole family's working to support the house. And there's a lot of internal struggle with him saying, oh, I got to be obedient to my dad. But then he starts listening to Bruce's music through a friend. And all of a sudden he realizes that what the music that Springsteen's doing on The River and on Born in the USA and Darkness on the Edge of Town, these songs are really speaking to him. He really identifies with it and kind of finds himself that way and is a writer himself and then branches out from there.
So the film is set in 1987, so that does make sense in that Born in the USA, which was released in 1984, would have such an impact as well.
Right. It was big to him. and the funny part is, okay, you're right, it's set in 87, so you're hearing, like, the Pet Shop Boys.
Right.
And Mental Is Anything, and all these groups in England that are big, and when he and his friend are telling everyone else about Bruce Springsteen, including people at his school's radio station, they're like, nobody listens to Bruce Springsteen anymore.
Right.
Because even though, you know, Springsteen was big in 84, 85, was born in the USA, England already moved on from that. Okay,
right.
They're like, well, what do you care about that for? That guy's old. We're into this new stuff. So he has some struggle there, too. And I just, it's a little, in some places, a little bit darker and a little bit more serious than just that trailer shows of him being lifted up by Bruce's music. But it's a great story. I really enjoyed it a lot.
That's exactly, to your point, that is exactly the way I would have viewed the film based on the way the trailer was. That's exactly what I thought. And that's why I was kind of, you know, I didn't see it because, so I haven't seen it thus far, just because I felt like, well, that's the movie and big deal.
Like I said, there's more to it. I as far as the grade goes, for this, it's probably my favorite movie I've seen this summer.
Wow.
Yeah, I give it a strong B plus because there was more to it. And on a side note, just today or yesterday on CBS This Morning Saturday, they did a feature on this guy who wrote a book. You know, the guy that's featured in the movie. He wrote a book, and that's how Springsteen knew of his story, because somebody sent him the book years ago, and then eventually it took 7 years to make the movie happen. And if you go to CBS's website, you can watch the feature again. It's really interesting stuff.
So how is the Springsteen music used throughout the movie?
Well, one of the cool parts is when he's listening to it, by the way, he's using a Walkman with cassette tapes. So, you know, younger people will look at that and go, what is that music he's listening to? What is that device that he's using? Okay. You know, why isn't it on a phone or
exactly.
An iPod or whatever? And when he's listening to a lot of the music, the lyrics are like typed above and they're like circling his head. So
actually
hearing what he's focusing in on while you're listening to the music. You're seeing it visually as well.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and he just, you know, he identifies with, you know, like Bruce's subjects about father and son issues, struggling to break out of this town. He's in this town in England he doesn't want to be in. He wants to do things that his family doesn't want him to do. So there's just a lot of different cliques in there, and he gets into it from a friend, and then he gets a girlfriend he starts to date, and she's not really into Bruce, but he starts to convert her, too, and explains why this music means so much to him. And also to his writing, because that's what he starts writing about for the school paper, is his fandom for Bruce's music.
You know, it's so interesting when you think about it. Now, you just said this may be your favorite film of the summer. Aside from the usual, you know, superhero films that become, you know, the big hits, and obviously this year, at least from a money standpoint, not really so much from a critical standpoint, from a money standpoint, the remake of The Lion King was certainly the big money maker. But when you think about it, aside from the superheroes or animation, this summer was really about some really interesting rock-based films, between Rocket Man, the story about Elton John, Yesterday, the story about the Beatles music that, you know, a young, once again, an Indian kid, you know, in some weird thing where there's a blackout and no one knows who the Beatles are, and he becomes a star by basically singing Beatles songs, which now, for some reason, no one has ever heard, and now this Blinded by the Light film. So it's interesting how, you know, rock and roll films have really held their own this summer.
Right. And the one thing I want to point out, and I mentioned this to a couple of friends today, you do not have to be a Springsteen fan or fanatic like you or I are to enjoy this, okay? Because if any, you know, artist music, whether it's the Beatles or the Stones or somebody like Pearl Jam or whoever has ever touched you and inspired you in whatever ways, if you've ever experienced that and kind of addressed it to your life and, oh, I identify with these songs and these lyrics, et cetera, if you've ever been through that, you will like this movie whether you're a Springsteen fan or not. So it's not, that's the other thing I want to stress, it's not just for Springsteen fans.
Right.
It's for anybody who's been looking for something to say, hey, I can latch onto this and this means something special to me.
Very good. That's a good point.
One other thing I wanted to mention, they also showed a movie trailer for the Springsteen movie that is coming out where he performs songs from that new album, Western Stars.
Right, yeah, that is going to open at the Toronto Film Festival in September, and I just read that, yeah, that's going to come out sometime
I think they said in October. The trailer said in October. Yeah. And they show Bruce with his band, and they show him on the road a lot, and he's got kind of this husky, gravelly, old prospectors type voice when he's talking about some of the songs and his lessons in life and things like that. So that'll be coming out in October to see.
Well, cool. Hold on, Mick. We'll still talk a little more, but I just want to take a quick break here. Jim Toronto filling in for David Plyer here at WGN 720 AM. It's about 3:49. No switching. Jim Toronto with your here with you at WGN 720 AM. And we are in the Pop Culture Club with Mick Kaler, where you were just talking about the new film called Blinded by the Light, which is just out now. Came out this week, in fact. And tells the story of a Pakistani teen living in England in 1987 who is turned on to the music of Bruce Springsteen, and it becomes a life-altering event for him. And as you said, not only did you like the film, but I think it was an important aspect that we should emphasize that you don't need to be a Springsteen fan to enjoy the film.
That's right. It's just, like I said, you just enjoy it for the story that it is. Kind of like, to be honest, even the Beatles movie, the Yesterday movie, I felt the same way. It's like, again, it's about somebody finding their way, and music is part of that sometimes, and that's what goes on in this movie, too.
Well, I tell you, what's interesting, too, you're talking about the effects of music, and we were talking about Woodstock a little earlier, and this is the 50th anniversary this weekend. As I said, in fact, today, right now, people were still 50 years ago. People were still at Woodstock, and I believe Jimi Hendrix came on at about 8 o'clock in the morning on even the fourth day. It was supposed to be a 3-day festival, but because they were so delayed on some things, they went into a fourth day. So 50 years ago, right now, Woodstock was happening, which is kind of an interesting kind of sidelight. But some sad news. That happened this week, too, that's somewhat tied to that when you talk about counterculture. I was very surprised to hear that Peter Fonda passed away.
Yeah, just the other day from lung cancer, and it's weird because I saw a picture of him that they showed from earlier this year, like maybe 5 months ago. He looked fine.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I feel sorry for Peter Fonda because, he came from the famous Fonda acting family. His father, Henry, is a acting icon in this country. His sister Jane went on to become an Academy Award winner, and went from being a sex symbol in her first early films like Barbarella and Clute, and then became a more serious actress later on, and has had one of the longer careers in Hollywood history, and certainly very well liked and very well respected. And Peter Fonda was the youngest of the group, and he was kind of always, the third wheel.
Kind of a ne'er-do-well possible, yeah. Not obviously not as prominent.
Yeah, but you cannot overlook the fact that he co-wrote and starred in one of the most influential films of the last 50 years. Talk about 1969 being a pivotal year. This movie came out in 69, just as we were talking about Woodstock 50 years old, the moon landing 50 years old, the Manson murder, sadly 50 years old, all taking place in 1969. But you cannot underestimate the influence that the film Easy Rider had on Hollywood.
Right, this raw, open, honest, kind of counterculture situation was a lot different than the movies that were out at that time, and it was groundbreaking for sure.
I mean, from a music standpoint, in many ways, started the independent film movement. A very young Dennis Hopper directed it. It was kind of filmed on the road, on the run. It was very anti establishment, as I said, Easy Rider, counterculture, two hippie, motorcycle guys. They're doing a drug deal. They're gumming up against, the establishment, as well as, kind of rednecks who don't want hippies. It was a very strong message. And as I said, just the type of film and the way it was shot really, helped to usher in the independent, film, you know, movement, as well as opening the doors for people, like in the 70s, you know, like Martin Scorsese and others, and Martin and Coppola, that really changed the way we see movies today.
Yeah, exactly.
And you cannot forget, a lot of people don't know this, Peter Fonda influenced the Beatles song from Revolver, She Said, She Said.
That's right. Why don't you give a quick recap of that?
Yeah, they were doing an acid trip with John Lennon and the Beatles in 1965. They were at some party in California. And Peter Fonda, apparently, when he was a young kid, had a near-death experience. And while they were on their acid trip, he kept telling John Lennon over and over, I know what it's like to be dead.
And it freaked John out, too.
Yeah, they were not really happy with that because they were sort of having this really cool, mellow, you know, drug experience. And this guy's talking about dying. But afterward, Lennon remembered that line. And in that song from Revolver, you know, it starts, she said, I know what it's like to be dead. So Peter Fonda, not only easy writer, but also influenced one of the great Beatles songs from Revolver.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break after. Can you hang around for another segment?
I got nowhere else to go.
Yeah, I mean, come on, where are you going? It's 4 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
Yeah, I want to talk about after the news, about some things going on in the pop culture magazine world, namely Entertainment Weekly and Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair, and just wondering, is there any need for these magazines anymore? Have they perhaps, you know, outlasted their importance? So we'll talk about that, but right now we'll take a quick break. It's Jim Toronto filling in for David Plyer. No switching. Jim Toronto with you this morning here at WGN, 720 AM in Chicago. Elton Jim's filling in for David Plyer, who will be back next week. I've been here the last 2 weeks filling in for David, and I was here the week before that filling in for Matt Bubala. So I've been on the night shift. Remember that song?
Sure, 1985, Commodores.
The Commodores. Is that the Commodores? But that was Commodores post Lionel, wasn't it?
Right, exactly. They had a couple hits without Lionel too.
Yeah, on the night shift. Yeah. So I was playing coming out of the news there, the great Dr. Hook song cover of the Rolling Stone, which became self-prophetic in that they wrote a song about being on the cover of Rolling Stone, and that song got them on the cover.
That was it. Got to advertise, guys. Yeah. Got to make a squeaky wheel, make it happen.
Yeah. I mean, no one else is going to do it for you. But the reason I played that song is because, you know, Rolling Stone was the, and we talked about the counterculture here, so everything sort of fits into the show tonight. But, yeah, there's no question that Rolling Stone played a pivotal role in the counterculture's emergence and later on became the baby boomer Bible, if you will, for music and pop culture. But, you know, it was sold, surprisingly, you know, it was up for sale. Jan Wenner, who founded the magazine in San Francisco in the late 60s and then moved it to New York, finally put it up for sale. It was bought by another publishing house, and that magazine used to be published twice monthly, and now it's a monthly. And to be honest, I have a lifetime subscription because about 20 years ago, they offered me a lifetime subscription for $30.
They were looking for that money. They needed that money fast. They needed a cash influx.
Yeah, $30. I mean, how could I not have said yes?
Sure.
Because to be honest, over the last 15, if not longer, I would never have renewed my subscription.
They might have known that, too.
Yeah. Now, when was the last time, because I know you used to read Rolling Stone religiously, when was the last time you picked up a Rolling Stone magazine?
Probably 5 or 6 years at least.
And with any regularity?
Yeah.
I mean, so even 5 or 6 years ago, and was that just, you know, oh, there's looks like an interesting story, or were you reading it regularly?
I think it was, it might have been a Springsteen cover story of something that I saw at the store, like, oh, I'll pick that up. But yeah, that was, like I said, it just kind of fell off my radar.
I mean, I remember Mick and I have known each other since college. We were both on a college radio station in Elmhurst College here in the western suburbs, good old WRSC-FM. And one of the things that we used to do on a regular basis, if you remember, because the magazine came out every 2 weeks, we would have a contest. If you remember this, we would predict who was going to be on the cover.
Right. It was like, you know, what music's happening or what trend is happening that they're going to jump on that we'll think they'll put on the cover.
Yeah, I mean, it was that much a part of our lives at that time. And once again, we were in our early to mid-20s, so music was very important, and it was kind of the driver of everything. But, that was, at least from my standpoint, how pivotal that magazine was. And I have to say, over the last 20 years, or even almost 25 years, I think that Rolling Stone has lost its way. It is no longer, by reputation, it still may be, the rock and roll, the media goes to, oh, Rolling Stone said this about this album or something. But Rolling Stone really has not played a major role in, changing tastes or, you don't go to Rolling Stone to read album reviews anymore. In fact, they're hardly even in there. They're like 100 words a piece. They're nothing anymore.
Well, it's that, and keep in mind, you're right, it's not this oracle we used to go to for things, but also look at the music has changed, okay? Rolling Stone used to be a rock and roll magazine, rock and roll music magazine, and then and culture magazine, too. Where's rock and roll that they can report on?
Yeah, exactly.
It happened years ago. I mean, we remember back in the 80s when Duran Duran was on the cover, or Madonna was on the cover, or Britney Spears and Taylor Swift. As years went on, it's like, okay, this is no longer the Rolling Stone interview with Pete Townsend or Bruce Springsteen. This is, we got to jump on whatever everybody thinks is hot, whether it's Boys to Men or whomever, and address that. So it's flavor changed.
Well, and that's my point of the larger issue is then, there's, like I said, I think really after Kurt Cobain died, and even when he was around, the grunge movement was very popular, but at the same time it was very short lived. And yes, it was a hit on MTV, but it really was still, grunge was still too loud and too abrasive to ever really become a mainstream phenomenon, even though, Target was selling flannels and, trying to get in on it. But, and so I really think that grunge gave birth to Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and that overt pop music, because grunge was just not going to make it with the majority of the mainstream.
Right, it wasn't palatable to the masses, as opposed to, like you said, a Britney Spears or a Christina Aguilera, these others who are like, oh, well, a lot more people can get into this music and this persona.
And so then all of a sudden, to your point, Rolling Stone had to start to then cover those more poppy kind of acts like Britney Spears, and like I said, Christina Aguilera, and then Justin Timberlake and Boys to Men, and suddenly it started to drift away from its rock roots, and then the outgrowth of that pop music, that's where hip hop then became more of a mainstream. And now hip hop is obviously, and rap is the dominant music. And so once again, while they keep trying to dot lines to rock and roll, it's not. I'm sorry. Hip hop and rap do not have anything to do with rock and roll. And they keep trying to connect it, but I believe they are two separate things. And Rolling Stone is really at this point more of a, I don't even know what kind of magazine it is. Is it a pop culture magazine? I don't know what it is.
I think they kind of hit into all fields, but it's mostly, like you said, music. And if there's it gets political, it gets culturally, relevant at times, but it doesn't have as definitive it doesn't have as much of a definition or an identity as it used to. It's all over the place.
So then why don't they just close it down? I mean, they have a presence online, but I mean, why have this? Is it just from nostalgia to keep printing it?
They might be someone's making some money on it still. I'm assuming that's why Jan Wenner sold it and somebody else took it up. And again, they're cutting costs with the fact that it's a monthly. And before that, by the way, and you remember this, Jim, that magazine used to be a large magazine. You could not fit it in your briefcase without folding it over a couple of times. And by the time Wenner sold it, it became like an Archie's comic book.
And that's why, I mean, they say, oh, look, the reason why it's thicker now is because it's a month's worth. There were times when I was getting this thing the last several years where the magazine was like 52 pages.
Yeah.
It was a pamphlet.
And that's with ads and everything.
Yeah, it was a pamphlet.
Right.
You know, and No Rolling Stone used to be printed on thick newspaper print, and the print was so small because there was so much text and so much content.
Yep.
And now, it, you know, like I said, it became, and I guess what, you know, and the Rolling Stone story is a little old now because it has been sold and it is what it is. And as I said, but what really kind of turned my head was what happened in the last several weeks, which once again, you just talk about branding. And I guess this is what's going on. But did you notice that Entertainment Weekly now comes out monthly?
Well, I just found that out from you because I let my subscription lapse about 3 years ago because I used to I was reading that since 1990 when it first came out. In my radio days, I used to get it free because they were trying to get people in the media to talk about Entertainment Weekly. And when I left radio, I subscribed to it. And about 3 years ago, I was like, I think I'm kind of done with this magazine.
I think for the last 10 or 12 years or 15 years, this magazine to me used to be, you know, it was required reading.
Yeah, it was. Now it's about music, television,
yeah,
movies, you know, somewhat cultural stuff and personalities, and it covered the gamut. It had everything from a Julia Roberts on the cover to, you know, the Dixie Chicks and you name it. Everybody was on there, and again, that's been diluted.
Yeah, and sadly, I think over the last 10 or 15, at least 10 to 12 years, the people in charge really began to exert a definite cultural and political agenda.
Sure.
And it was very clear. And I understand that many ways the entertainment world is the spot where a lot of movements or trends gain their momentum and steam. And that is how they are introduced into the mainstream. I understand that. But at the same time, it got very political. It was becoming much more culturally diverse, and it really went all in on comic books and superheroes.
Right. Well, it's funny, the geeks, you know, the Comic-Cons, yeah, and all that stuff pretty much took over. Graphic novels, all those kind of things became a major force. And again, if you notice, Jim, when you're talking about that, it became kind of an age issue. It was like if you were over 40, you probably weren't interested in reading Entertainment Weekly anymore.
No, and so it, to me, it became a very niche publication. I've been saying for the last 10 years that if that magazine was not owned by Time Warner, which was such a huge conglomerate, that there was no way it would ever have lasted. And sure enough, it was recently sold. And just like Rolling Stone's new owners, these new owners now have taken Entertainment Weekly, and Weekly is in the title,
right,
and made it into a monthly. And to me...
So they're not going to change it to Entertainment Monthly.
No, they're going to keep that because of the brand, and it's still, you know, it does have a web presence, and they're pushing the web presence, as is Rolling Stone. And so there's been two issues now with the new monthly format, and as it stands right now, I don't know what this magazine is. It, you know, it certainly cannot be timely, where it used to be, you know, timely, and you know, because it was printed every week.
Yeah.
But now if it's printed that far in advance, so it's kind of just all over the board. I mean, there's a new layout. It's just this large, you know, headlines, which there's, I don't know what the heck it is. But to me, once again, I've been a reader since it, like you said, since it premiered in 1990. But I think this magazine for a long time has lost its way. I don't know what it wants to be now. And I just think it's funny that a monthly magazine is called Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah. Well, part of the other thing, too, besides the changes culturally and content-wise, I was thinking about this after you told me you wanted to talk about this. Okay, Entertainment Weekly, that's too slow, okay?
Right.
We have Facebook. We have Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, podcasts. And here's the deal, and this goes to Rolling Stone, too. Remember Rolling Stone, they'd say, coming up next week, the Rolling Stone interview with, you know, Bruce Springsteen,
right,
or Eddie Vedder or whatever, and it was a major deal. Today, when an interview is conducted, 15 seconds later, it goes out to the world.
Yeah.
They don't wait 2 weeks. Entertainment Weekly is another great example. When a new movie would come out, like, say, the Quentin Tarantino movie. Okay, it used to be a month before the movie came out, they'd sit down with Tarantino, they'd do this interview, and they'd say, oh, we're coming up, we're going to show about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now, when they do an interview like that, when anybody does it, whether it's Entertainment Weekly or whatever, they'll just put it right to the world right away. Say, guess what he said right now? It's an immediate reaction because we've got this attention deficit hyperactivity disordered society. We want this stuff now. I don't want to wait 2 weeks from now to hear what, you know, Paul right. McCartney said about his new tour. I want to know about it this instant.
And
so these magazines are somewhat obsolete because of that.
Yeah, and so my point is, you know, that's fine. There are some ideas and some thing, you know, at one time it was really important to have a good buggy whip.
Right.
But we don't need a buggy whip anymore.
Right.
And so there aren't any. And Rolling Stone, you cannot, as I said before, you can't deny its impact that it had on the culture. But its time has passed. And maybe you want to have an online, presence. That's fine. But I don't think the magazine, once ink hits paper, it's already obsolete, to your point. So why bother? And now Entertainment Weekly becomes a monthly. It's already confusing. You know, the Entertainment Weekly has a website. Drive people there. Make that.
And the other point about that is, like you said about the print going to ink to paper, print is still important, but everybody's going to read it online. They're going to read it on their phone. They're going to read it on their PC. So, again, waiting for it to be printed, set out to the newsstands and all that, it's not necessary anymore.
Yeah. I'm going to give it a shot here, but the first two issues of Entertainment Weekly now is a monthly. I am not impressed. I'm paging through it very quickly, even though it's thicker. You know, mm-hmm. is it? You know, it's over 100 pages as opposed to 50. Once again, I was getting some issues. They were like a pamphlet, but you know, I'm still paging through it, and there's not a lot that's grabbing it. And to your point you made earlier, which is a good point, you know, it might be some age thing going on here. What I'm reading about is not important to me as it might be to someone in their teens or their 20s or their 30s. But I just don't see what the value is in this hard copy. It's not a shot against the magazine. It's just that maybe time has passed it. It was a good idea. It made its mark. It had its run. But there are times when those runs end.
Exactly. And getting back to Entertainment Weekly for a second, one of the other things that everybody forgets is so many of today's, especially younger stars, they don't have to wait to sit down with Entertainment Weekly to do an interview or make a comment. They go on Twitter.
Yeah.
They go on Snapchat. It's Taylor Swift and Miley Cyrus and Katy Perry and even Steve Martin and others. They just put out their thoughts constantly or their information constantly. I see more updates about comedian specials from online than I ever would have seen in print anyway. Everything's more immediate, and the stars themselves are more accessible to just sending stuff out themselves with no publicists and no formal interviews.
Yeah, no, so I don't know. We'll see. But seems to me that some of these great magazines, and they've had great histories, maybe there's time and their idea, the idea of them and what they bring to the table now is just their time is done. So
yeah.
maybe it's time to just say thank you and good night. And on that, I will say thank you and good night to you, Mick. You go get some sleep.
I will do that.
And thank you so much for staying up with us and sharing some really interesting views, as you always do. Thank you so much.
You bet. My pleasure, pal. We'll see you.
Okay, Mick Kaler joining us here at the Pop Culture Club. Jim Tarano filling in for David Plyer here at WGN. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. No switching.
Ask not.
The Beatles. Circus is on the air.
The president does it.
Sometimes you feel like
that means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you
tear
don't.
Tear down this wall.
Here's Johnny.
Hey, Luke. May the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
We're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
John has been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in six seasons, it's one goal achieved. The Chicago Blackhawks
win the Stanley Cup! The Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup!
It's in time, and the Chicago Cubs win the World Series! The Cubs have done it!
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
Well, it's not exactly Dave Plyer. It's Jim Toronto filling in for Dave Plyer this week, but Dave will be back next week. But part of that intro is certainly correct, because the other name mentioned is none other than Dave Schwann. Hello, Schwannaroo.
Good morning. How you doing?
How you doing?
Okay, pretty good. Getting good, ready good, for good. Another Sunday here.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, just a month ago, we were seeing semblance of daylight at this time of the morning. We're
really?
Not seeing that right now.
Daylight?
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, just, you know, what they used to call the crack of dawn.
Right.
Now, that doesn't roll around until maybe 5:30.
Right, and we are seeing the
days
get shorter.
Getting a little shorter.
Yes, they are. Isn't it amazing how, I notice now that the sun is down at by 7:30, and just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, it was 8:30.
8:30, quarter to nine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. I think it's a conspiracy theory myself.
They're shortening the days on us.
There they are.
Little by little, they're taking away minutes, and pretty soon it's going to be only 23 hours a day. You watch. It may take a while, but they're going to take an hour away from us, Dave.
And you won't even know the difference.
You know what?
You'll never notice.
They'll never even tell us.
That's right.
And suddenly,
it'll just happen,
and not a fire will be shot, not a gun will be shot, not a bullet will be shot, not a protest sign. It'll just be gone. And we won't even realize it, and we won't even be mad. They will have done it. That big they out there that we have been talking about for hundreds of years, they will do it.
It's them.
It's them and they.
That was the name of a 1950s sci-fi thriller. Them.
Well, you them.
Know, invaders.
And from... them was the name of Van Morrison's first band.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. They did. Whoa. Gloria. Yeah.
Boy, How about that one?
How about that, Dave? Well, you know what takes you back? Now, you know, you're a little older than me. Do you remember Woodstock? We're talking about this day in history. I've been talking about it all morning. 50 years ago, right now, as we speak,
yeah,
people were at Max Yazger's farm.
That's right.
In Bethel, New York, right now. Even if it's 2:20 in the morning in California, they were there. They were still there, because Jimi Hendrix actually was pushed on until in the early morning hours,
mm-hmm,
when he played his historic Star Spangled Banner version. It was about 8 in the morning. So right now, you can say, where were some people 50 years ago right now? They were still at Woodstock.
In the muddy fields, because it rained.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm talking about California. No, they were in on the East Coast, so it would be 5:40, but they were still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yep.
I was thinking of Monterey.
That's right. Yeah.
So
yes,
do you remember,
Monterey.
So how old were you? I don't want to give your age, but
the,
I mean, you
no,
were...
that was the same year, of course, of the moon landing, so
right.
I was going to turn 13.
So you were, I would assume, because you've probably been a news guy since you were, you know, out of the womb. So, I'm sure that you were very aware of Woodstock, right?
Everybody was, because it was covered as, you know, really the culmination of the 60s, because it was 69, and everybody was going after 1968, which was just such a disastrous year.
Yeah, right.
Everybody's saying, okay, let's move into the 70s, and maybe we can have something a little bit better. Maybe we can resolve Vietnam. Maybe we can do something about equal rights for people, you know, that sort of thing. And Woodstock was one of those things that just caught fire. I have a regret. I talked my parents into getting me the 3-LP set.
Oh, right.
For Christmas.
Yeah.
That came out a year or two later.
Yes.
I talked my parents, my dad and mom, into giving me that for a Christmas present. I played that album to death.
Wow, you did, huh?
Yeah.
Cool.
And, you know, you mentioned the Jimi Hendrix.
Star Spangled Banner.
There was a cut on that album that preceded the Star Spangled Banner, you know. And he came up and he said, "We're just going to be jamming, that's all." And they were, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
But My story is, my regret is that I no longer have that album.
That's one of those that you should have kept.
Yeah.
Yeah, somewhere down the line. Yeah, that, now, what's ironic, I mean, given, you know, now they have access to so much, you know, past thing, you know, past, you know, content. There is, so I got news for you, Dave. If you want to go crazy, and now that you've got this, you know, this high living luxury lifestyle of yours.
Oh, really? That's news to me.
There is a 38 disc set of every piece of audio from Woodstock, even the stage announcements.
Yeah. Some of those were included.
Yeah. Well, this album has everything, because if you, I don't know if you know, but even though there was that Woodstock album that you're talking about that came out in like 1970,
right?
There was a 3-album set, but there was a lot of bands that were not even
included.
Album,
yeah,
and there was
yeah.
a lot of bands that were not in the film either.
Yes,
you know, and you know, this has everything. Guess how much it costs?
38 disc,
$800.
Wow,
you can listen to every audio moment of Woodstock for $800 if you want.
Now think of the amount of analog tape it took to record that.
I know.
There was no digital back
no,
then.
No, no. I mean, yeah, 38 discs. I mean, that's, you got to be a Woodstock. I mean, hopefully for the people that were there, you know, I would want to get that just as a, you know, as a final kind of keepsake.
Yeah, yeah.
But for those of us that were not there, and I was only 5 at the time, so I have no recollection of Woodstock. I grew up hearing about it, but certainly didn't, you know, had no idea what was going on.
Yeah, I would hasten to add, too, you were asking me if I remember. I remember because of news coverage, watching, you know, Walter Cronkite, David Brinkley, people like that, they would do stories on the news. It was not televised.
Right, no.
It was filmed, yes, but it wasn't televised.
And you know, when you make a point about 1969, I mean, think about that year. Think about that summer. Think about that from say, July, about that month and a half. You had the moon landing on July 20th, which was amazing. In 69.
Mm-hmm. And then less than a month later,
you had Woodstock on the 15th through the 17th. Then, sadly, you had the Manson murders on August 9th. And then later, you had the Altamont Rolling Stones concert, while you had Woodstock, which was this amazing 3-day event where there was no violence, there were no deaths, there were no murders, there was no anything. It was literally 3 days of music and peace. And then Altamont happened on the West Coast with the Rolling Stones, and they had the the motorcycle gang, the Hell's Angels were the security there. A few people got killed, and it turned out to really be a very dark and violent event, and really kind of, many people say at the time, really put an end to the 60s, where the decade started with such great optimism with John F. Kennedy in 1961 when he became president, and then ended on this very dark note with the Altamont Rolling Stones concert where there was a murder. And that really sort of, you know, bled into the 70s, where you continue to have a lot of turmoil with Vietnam and Watergate and, you know, inflation. And I mean, there was just so much going on.
The double digit inflation. John Updike, the writer, had a term for the 1960s. He called it a slum of a decade.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
He called it a slum of a decade.
Yeah, I mean,
that summed it up. And they talked about, you know, slums, people living in poverty, you know, so his terminology was pretty accurate, pretty spot on, really.
Well, interestingly too, I mean, so let's not wallow in the slum. But interestingly, not only did Woodstock take place 50 years ago today, but Curtis had dug something up here. Curtis, the producer, on this date, 1962, the Beatles made their debut with Ringo Starr as their drummer.
Not Pete Best. Yeah.
And what's interesting about that as well is that a lot of people don't know that when the Beatles then went into the studio to record the first time First of all, Pete Best was, George Martin said, no, this guy's not going to cut it. So the Beatles were already thinking about getting rid of Pete Best anyway, because they weren't really happy with his drumming. And then George Martin kind of validated that.
Yeah, I also read, too, where he really wasn't kind of a team player.
Well, you know what?
He played with the band, but he wasn't a collaborator.
Well, there's a lot of stories, too. Not only is there that story, but then the other story is that one of the reasons that the Beatles kicked him out was Pete Best was actually very good looking. If you ever saw pictures of him, he was a good looking guy, and he was probably the best looking Beatle of the George, Paul, and John group.
Oh, okay.
And there may have been some.
I don't recall seeing a picture.
Oh, yeah.
Some jealousy there.
Yeah, there may have been some jealousy that he got
that was going to steal.
Well,
that
he he already did. You know, when they were a lot of times he would, you know, when they were performing, you know, he would be the guy that the girls all went to.
They'd all go over to.
And, you know, not to say anything about Ringo, but look who they replaced the good-looking guy with.
So, be nice, man. Yeah. Be nice.
So there was no, there was going to be no competition anymore from the drummer. And ironically, though, it's so funny. I mean, So George Martin says no to Pete Best, right? So there was already this, you know, internal kind of, you know, whispering about getting rid of Pete Best, even though, he was integral into the development of the band because his mother owned a place called the Casbah Club in Liverpool where the Beatles as teenagers played. And that's where they really became a band. So there was a tie-in. Pete Best's mom owned this little club that was basically the basement of their house, but that's where the Beatles really became a band and started playing together, and yet they kicked him out. But my point is, George Martin says, okay, Pete Best isn't going to cut it. They bring in Ringo. Ringo starts to play on Love Me Do, right? Their first single. George Martin says, this guy's not cutting it either, and they brought another drummer.
Another one?
On Love Me Do, there are two versions. The single version, the single that the version that they released to the radio before the album does have Ringo's version. But the version that is on the first album of the Beatles, Please Please Me, that is a drummer named Andy White, who was a session drummer who George Martin brought in.
Brought in just for the session.
Just for the session, and Ringo plays tambourine on it.
Okay.
So the Beatles, you know, their drummer has always been, you know, there's always been, and I've seen interviews with Ringo, and he says that later on George Martin profusely apologized to Ringo for doing that because he came to become a very big fan of Ringo's drumming. And he said, I'm so sorry that I brought this other guy in that was definitely... you know, a very, you know, mean thing to do, and I didn't see what you were bringing, and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, the Beatles certainly have had an interesting history with drummers, as do most bands.
Yeah, oh, yeah, and I understand that it was either John, or rather George Martin, or John Lennon, or Paul, apologized later to Pete Best after they became the super band that they did, and they left him in the dust.
Yeah, well... he just
ended up playing locally.
Oh yeah, no. Well, what they could have done, I mean, apologies are nice. A check would have been even better.
Yeah, you know, there you go.
I mean,
there you go.
I mean, you could take those apologies and you could put those. Give me a, how about a little scratch here? I mean, my God, those guys. I mean, if you think about it, as I said, there are so many crazy stories that go on, you know, in the world of entertainment where there's these moments that, and this one person and another person and who knows what the dynamic is. But, you know, would the Beatles have been the Beatles without Ringo, though? You know, that's the question. You can
speculate. I mean, that's not going to do any good. There's no point in that.
No, no. But, in 1962, on August 18th, that was the first time that Ringo sat in as an official member of the Beatles, and he played, now get this, talk about a great gig. He played at the Horticulture Society Dance. That's where the Beatles were playing. In 1962 at the Horticultural Society Dance in Birkenhead, England.
Where is that?
I don't know, but
it must be outside Liverpool.
But about a year and a half later, they were on the Ed Sullivan Show. Talk about a life-changing experience.
Walter Cronkite said that somebody in CBS had done a piece on the Beatles, you know, this up and coming group in England. And Walter Cronkite was not a Beatles fan. He wasn't.
Oh, really?
No, he never.
Oh, that's interesting.
Liked, he never was cared for. He was just wasn't a rock and roll kind of guy.
Yeah, right.
And so, but he told somebody at CBS, a producer or somebody, and they ran the story on the Beatles, you know, and apparently that's how Sullivan got the idea to have them on. One thing led to another. And look what happened.
Well, I'll tell you, I give Ed Sullivan, who was probably the king of the squares. I mean, this guy was very square. But at the same time, he certainly knew what the people wanted. And he and in order to make his show popular and to get viewers.
He had the Stones on.
Yeah.
He had the Doors.
He had Elvis.
He had Elvis on.
Yeah. I mean, he still, he didn't let his personal, which I give him a lot of credit, you know, because so many of people
his
power.
Personal taste.
Yeah, he didn't let his personal taste
interfere with what was going to be on for entertainment.
Exactly. Yeah. And he said, hey, if the people want this, or here's something, you know, hey, these kids are screaming, there's got to be something to this, even if it's not my taste. I'm not the arbiter of this necessarily. And so he gave people like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Elvis Presley, you know, amazing exposure on that show, which everybody watched on Sunday nights.
Yep. Including me.
Right.
I remember watching it.
Well, and there are people that will say they know exactly where they were.
I remember watching it.
Yeah, where they were, you know, when the Beatles were on February 7th or February 9th. Or when Elvis was first on. So it's an amazing, that was just an amazing time. As I said, I don't know if the 60s were a complete slum, as John Updike might have said.
Oh, no. But
the ending.
What comes to mind when we think of the 1960s? Riots, assassinations.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, think Vietnam.
I mean, you had the assassinations.
Then you also had the space program.
You had the assassination in 68 of both Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy.
Kennedy.
And then you had the crazy Chicago Democratic Convention.
The Democratic Convention riot. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was a very turbulent
time. I remember watching that, too. And I'm watching that on TV on Michigan Avenue, and I'm going, geez. I know there. I know where that is.
That's not far from my house.
We've driven down that street. I know right where that is.
No kidding.
I really do.